From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The researcher Gregory Prince says in the first century of the LDS Church, there wasn't really a downside for its highest-ranking leaders serving for life as they do. In those first 100 years, the average age a man would have gone into the Quorum of the 12 Apostles was 36. Today, the average age is nearly 60, which means by the time they've become senior leaders, they're in their 80s or 90s. And Prince points out the obvious. Those are notoriously difficult years physically. In a new article Prince has co-written, he points out half of Mormon leaders who have reached their 90s since 1950 eventually had some degree of mental incapacitation. Today in the program, Prince is joining us to talk about the consequences of age for governing the LDS Church and what he and others are proposing you do about it. After the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the past few years, the researcher Gregory Prince has been examining age in the leadership of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Take the top five ranking leaders in the LDS Church, and by ranking, I mean seniority. That's how it works in the Mormon hierarchy. Your rank is determined by the date you came into the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. And the top five ranking leaders average 87 years of age. In a new article Prince has co-authored, he points out Mormon apostles, like everybody else, are living longer these days because of the advances in medical technology. And what that means for everybody is that the chances you'll be afflicted with some kind of dementia or some other cognitive impairment are just much higher. And it now seems clear the current leader of the LDS Church, Thomas S. Monson, is suffering from some kind of dementia, though we haven't been able to confirm that. What Prince says in the article is that, first, there are consequences to having leaders who are physically incapacitated. And secondly, he says there are ways to fix this. He says there's no scriptural or doctrinal reason why the LDS Church can't create age limits for its leaders. Today in the program, Greg Prince is joining us to talk about all of this, but I want to begin by reading a statement from the LDS Church. We asked them to comment and possibly participate in the show. Eric Hawkins of the Public Affairs Department sent us this yesterday afternoon. President Monson, he writes, is 89. It's natural that he and others in church leadership are feeling the effects of advancing age. However, President Monson spoke at General Conference. He attended all the meetings. He comes to the office every day. He attends First Presidency and committee meetings. He leads the discussion and makes decisions. The workload of the First Presidency is up to date, he writes. President Monson has always been private about his health, but appreciates the prayers and sustaining support of church members, as do all of the First Presidency and the 12. Emeritus status is not a consideration for members of the First Presidency and Quorum of the 12. Apostles serve for life. That's pretty much, aside from the age difference, the same statement we received a few years ago when we asked a similar question, but we wanted to get that on the record. Joining us throughout the hour is Gregory Prince. He's an independent historian, also an active Latter-day Saint. He's written biographies of LDS Church President David O. McKay and most recently of church historian Leonard Arrington. The article that we're talking about, which he co-authored, is called Gerontocracy in the Future of Mormonism, which is due out in the fall issue of Dialogue. That's a journal focused on Mormon thought and culture. Greg Prince wrote it along with Mormon historian Lester Bush and attorney and former Dialogue co-editor Brent Rushforth. Greg Prince is joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. And Greg Prince, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Nice to be back.
I want to get the kind of delicate stuff, although the nature of this conversation is going to almost always be delicate. But I want to get a couple of things out of the way. What can we say about President Thomas S. Monson's current condition? I mean, it's obvious he's frail. As the church statement pointed out, he's 89. But the question is he cognitively impaired? You write in your article that it's an open secret, if not common knowledge, that he's been suffering from dementia now for several years. What can we say about that?
Well, I think in the first place, we do want to respect his desire for privacy and the church's desire not to go where the data don't allow us to go. And I do respect that. Yeah. I think, however, that watching from a distance even, you can infer some things by seeing what doesn't happen. And what hasn't happened for several years is that he has not conducted a session in general conference. He, in more recent years, has not spoken the four times during the general conference that church presidents traditionally have done. And in the past couple of general conferences, appearance at the podium has been trimmed to twice. And rather than speaking for approximately 20 minutes, he's spoken about 4 to 5 minutes each time. He did hold one press conference the day after he was sustained as the new church president, but that's been it. And his public appearances, particularly any that would have a non-scripted speaking part, I think have vanished. So all of this says that whatever the reason, and I'm really not interested in trying to specify what the reasons might be, he is, as the church says, feeling the effects of advancing age. And it can be seen publicly.
Yeah. I think you're right. It does seem understandable that a private individual would want to keep their health condition just that, private. But can we also say the obvious, that he is the leader of a very large church with a very public role in the world? Is that reasonable? And I don't want to go on about this, Greg, I promise, but is it reasonable to want to keep that private?
I think there comes a point when if the institution is not going in a direction for lack of leadership that it might go, that that's an appropriate question to be asking. There are some prerogatives that only the president of the LDS Church can take. There have been times in the past, for instance, where there has been an ailing president, and even a very powerful, capable counselor, Gordon Hinckley, pulled back and said there are things that I won't do as a counselor because they're the prerogative of the president, and yet the president wasn't able to perform that.
Right. I want to dig in on that question, actually, the importance of having a strong leader. But let me ask this. Would there be anything wrong with a Mormon president, Mormon prophet, if they did have dementia? Would that in any way disqualify Thomas S. Monson, for example, from being a legitimate prophet as far as Mormons are concerned? I mean, aren't all leaders, don't they concede that everyone, including leadership, are afflicted with the afflictions of mortality?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between saying that he would be disqualified versus that his functioning would be impaired, and the latter is what the church has acknowledged, that he's not capable of performing at the level that he would have several years ago, and certainly not the level that he did during his decades in the Quorum of the Twelve. But that doesn't necessarily disqualify him from sitting in that seat. I think the more appropriate question to ask is, what is in the best interest of the church as it moves into the future, and as we have a hierarchy that, medically speaking, for sure is going to get older and older?
Yeah. I guess, but this is the question, though, that I'm asking. It seems like, and we'll come back to this a little bit later, because one of the things that you mentioned in the article is that the severity of some of the medical problems experienced by church presidents over the years have in some cases been hidden from the general church membership. And my question is, why would leadership want to hide some of those details? Wouldn't most members just realize that this is what happens in mortality, that if their president was cognitively impaired, that this is just what happens in mortality? I mean, why would that disrupt the, you know, so-called testimonies of the rank and file by hearing that their leaders are afflicted?
Oh, I don't think it would disrupt that.
Yeah.
And if you look, for instance, at President McKay, though he didn't come out and make
a statement. Let's say that's David O. McKay.
David O. McKay, yes. That that his eldest son, Lawrence, at one point said, we are not going to read his talks in General Conference anymore because we don't want to convey a false impression that our father is writing these talks, because the talks were assembled from prior discourses that he had given. In the case of President Kimball, I think there was more openness. There was public disclosure that he had had subdural hemorrhage and that he had had cranial surgeries. With President Ezra Taft Benson, it was much more guarded. There was not the public disclosure of what was going on. And this was problematic in the case of his grandson, who felt that this was doing the church a disservice. So it has tended to go back and forth. Most recently, last year, L. Tom Perry, who was one of the senior apostles, was very candid in saying, look, I have terminal cancer. I'm going into hospice care.
Yeah.
And that was by his own insistence that that be out there in the press. I think it probably has been a private decision, and that's why you've seen this back and forth institutionally, that in one administration there's more public disclosure than in the next administration. But to get back to your question, I don't think that the church membership would be ill-served by full disclosure.
In the article, you write that medical technology is, of course, extending the lifespans of people. And that has, you say, is creating a bit of a problem for church leadership because of the policy that the highest-ranking leaders serve for life. So just point that out to us. How does it work? For those uninitiated, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and the First Presidency, this is, you've sort of called them the Q12 in the article. These are the top-ranking leaders. And just explain how it works. They serve for life, basically.
Yes. Gordon B. Hinckley was the church president immediately prior to President Monson. I believe he was on a show with Mike Wallace, who asked, well, how do you become president? He chuckled and he said, it's simple. You just outlive the 11 men in front of you.
Right.
And that really is the case, that now the succession to the presidency is determined by the length of tenure in the Quorum of the 12, not by age, not by anything else. That was not always the case, and I think that's an important part of our discussion today to show that there has been fluidity in the way that the Mormon Church chooses its top leaders, and that at least leaves the door open to the possibility that that fluidity might extend into the future.
Right. Great. We'll come back to that because I do want to work through all of that. Let's talk about, though, the trend. For many decades in Mormonism, obviously, you say this wasn't really – there wasn't much of a downside. In the 19th century, leaders were relatively young. But the trend over the years, of course, has been that the age at – you know, when these leaders are chosen to go into the Quorum of the 12, that has started to increase. So give us the trend line here. The average ages here that we're talking about compared to the early years of the church?
Well, if you go almost decade by decade, you start out in the 30s, back when the church was founded, and now the average age going into the Quorum of the 12 is in the 60s. What we did, Doug, to try to put some numbers on this was to say, is there a surrogate that we could measure that would approximate the ability of a man to function in that office? And what we came up with was the ability to stand at a general conference and deliver a sermon. The church has published
because you have data of you have data of this.
We have data.
Yeah, that's a way to measure. I see. Okay, keep going. Sorry.
Since 1897, the church has published every 6 months a report of the general conference that includes the complete text of all of the sermons that were delivered, who delivered them. And the one constant during that whole time has been that what is generally abbreviated the Q15, which would be the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and the three members of the First Presidency, each one of those men has spoken at least once at every general conference. So what we did was to go back for over 100 years of general conference reports and track each member of the Q15 each general conference and say, was he able to deliver a speech? Now, there were a couple of qualifiers because some of them were on foreign missions at a time when they couldn't easily come back for general conference. But if they were in town, were they able to stand up and deliver that sermon? And we accumulated over 3,000 data points and then said, what do these data points tell us? And what they clearly showed was that up until the mid-1960s, age really was not a significant impairment.
Yeah.
That most of these men were able to deliver a general conference address, in some cases, up until the time just before they died. So they didn't miss a single general conference. Some missed one general conference. It was very unusual that any of them would miss two in a row. And the reason was that at that point, when they got sick, they tended to go downhill pretty quickly, and medical care was not advanced to the point that it was very good at reversing that trend. So it was kind of once you stepped onto that slippery slope, it moved very quickly towards death. That changed by the mid-1960s, and so you had not only more and more of these men who were not capable of standing up and giving that sermon, but they tended not to be able to for more consecutive general conferences. The most extreme example being Marion Romney, who for many years was in the first presidency. He missed 11 consecutive general conferences prior to his death. So that's 5.5 years.
Yeah. You mentioned Gordon B. Hinckley as being kind of an exception to a precedent here, the trend. You want to say something about his kind of remarkable health? Because he absolutely bucked a trend, it seems.
I think just about everything about President Hinckley was remarkable.
Yeah.
He really was an exceptional human being, no matter how you wanted to gauge it. He was 97 years old and was still functioning mentally right along with the rest of the pack, if not even better. Physically, clearly, you slow down when you reach 97, but he was still up and about. He left the office early one day in the middle of handwriting a sermon because he wasn't feeling well, and 3 days later, he passed away. So that represented an extremely unusual situation where a church leader was well into his 90s and in full command of his faculties and then had a very abrupt exit.
Yeah. You mentioned in your article that there have been several episodes, and we'll talk about some of the particulars here, during the past 50 or 60 years in which ailing presidents, to quote you here now, illustrate the risk of a gerontocracy on church governance. You write this, about half of those who have reached their 90s since 1950, eventually had some degree of mental incapacitation. So this is the issue that you're trying to deal with, at least. And I want to just sort of, we'll talk about the particulars a little bit later, but just give us a sense of what you're proposing. What you're suggesting is that maybe church leaders, it's time for them to consider an age limit.
Well, let me drill down a little bit on the medical issue here.
Okay.
I'm old enough to have used slide rules, and the mental image that comes to mind is taking that middle piece of wood on the slide rule, and you can slide it back and forth. Think of that representing the whole human population. You slide that to the right to indicate that the average life expectancy is increasing. But on the bottom of that slide rule is a zone that stays put. And so as you slide that slide rule to the right, more and more of the population will be crossing into that zone.
Yeah.
Does that give a good mental image to you?
Absolutely.
And that zone could be called the zone of mental impairment, the zone of dementia. What has happened is that as we have aged physically so that that top part of the slide rule is moving to the right, the zone of dementia has stayed put. And so it's predictable on a population basis what percentage of the population will be mentally impaired when they get to a particular age. And more of us are getting to that age. So you can't predict it for an individual, but you certainly can on a class average basis. And that's what we're seeing, that we're seeing more and more of these men. It's just a question of they're getting older, and that's one of the things that medicine has not yet been able to fix. We can't slide that dementia zone to the right at the same velocity that we're sliding the life expectancy to the right.
Gregory Prince is with us. He's co-written an article called Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism. He co-wrote it with Lester Bush and Brent Rushforth. It's going to be published in the fall issue of the Mormon Journal called Dialogue. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the effect of old age on the way the LDS Church is governed. In the United States, Mormonism is the only faith whose top leader serves until he dies. Now, that was one thing in the past when medical technology didn't prolong a person's life, but people, of course, live longer these days. The researcher Gregory Prince says this is an issue that the church should consider changing its succession policy for, and we're talking about that today. He's co-written an article called Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism. I'll give you some more details about that a little bit later on the program. Greg Prince is joining us today from a studio in Washington, D.C. One of the things that you work through in the paper is how the LDS Church sort of ended up at this point. The church statement that we received, both of them, said in a kind of matter-of-fact way that emeritus status is not a consideration for members of the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve, that apostles serve for life. So has it always been that way? Because I want you to work through this. You say there's no doctrinal reason, there's no scriptural reason why there couldn't be some kind of adjustment here.
That's right. There is no scriptural mandate that any church officer serve until death. It's been a tradition. It's a tradition that was followed for more than a century by all general officers. And then in the 1970s, that changed rather dramatically for one of those levels of general church leadership, the 70.
Yeah. Any scriptural reason why it?
Nope. Nope. There's no scriptural. It's just a precedent. And that precedent in the case of the 70 was broken so that even though it was not announced at that age, the age of 70 became the age at which a member of the first quorum of 70 would go to emeritus status and essentially would retire.
Well, I think what's interesting also about all of this is the way they've settled on it being, as you say, a tradition, not scriptural, not necessarily doctrinal. And in the article you point out, Joseph Smith, he died before he could kind of make it clear about how succession should work. He gave these kind of conflicting instructions about how it should work. Maybe say something about that, because your point in showing that is that this succession thing has evolved over time, that people have just sort of adjusted based on what's going on.
Yes, and the problem wasn't that Joseph Smith didn't look to the future to say, well, what might the succession policy be? It's that he outlined too many options and didn't firmly settle on any of them. Now, the one that settled the issue for the group of Latter-day Saints who went west was the Quorum of the Twelve. Initially, the Quorum of the Twelve acting as a group and not even a successor president to Joseph Smith until 3 years later. But there were nearly a dozen other options, and some of those options were grasped by other prospective leaders who went off in different directions geographically with their various flocks. Many of those traditions died away, but some of them continue till today, the prominent one being the Community of Christ, which for many years was the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
You also mentioned in the article that there have been leaders over time who have suggested that it wasn't necessary that it work this way. Heber J. Grant, you quote, he said this. Here, you quote him in the article, "I do not think it is absolutely necessary that in a case of the death of the president of the church and the subsequent reorganization of the church, that the president of the 12 apostles should be made the president of the church." I mean, that's how it works now. There's this very clear line. But what Heber J. Grant, who was church president, said was it doesn't necessarily have to work that way, right?
That's right. That's an option that's still open. And in times past, senior church leaders have acknowledged that, yes, this is the way that we do it, but it's not necessary that that always be the manner in which we do it.
Lorenzo Snow, also a church president, said that they had that church leaders had the power to select the first presidency. You didn't even have to go within the quorum of the 12. You could go outside of it. So it seems like there's a bit of leeway here.
There is. And in one notable instance, they went outside of the quorum of the 12, not for a church president, but for a member of the church presidency. And that was J. Reuben Clark, who was in the Foreign Service at the time and came into the first presidency without ever having served as a general authority.
There have been times, you mentioned David O. McKay's son here, times when the family of these leaders have resisted the attempts by the church to portray the president as fully functioning when he's not. I want to kind of work through that a little bit. Steve Benson, you mentioned, I guess that's who you were referring to earlier, grandson of former church president Ezra Taft Benson. He
yes.
told the press that the church was perpetuating a myth, that you had Ezra Taft Benson who was, he could barely speak more than a few words. He didn't really recognize people. He was being spoon-fed by nurses, and yet he was sort of being, and I think Benson's used this word, sort of propped up to give an image, to sort of perpetuate a myth. Would you say something about that?
Well, I never had any contact with President Benson. I had some contact with Steve Benson. I can certainly sympathize with him as a family member wanting the church to portray the actual fitness of his grandfather and yet seeing it portrayed differently. There are institutional prerogatives that got in the way of that happening, and I think it was very unfortunate because I think that was the major catalyst for Steve resigning his church membership, yeah. And I think that was very unfortunate.
I want to come back to this idea that you say that in some cases the severity of these medical problems have been hidden from the membership for as long as possible, and that people who are hiding it are pretty good at hiding it. And you mentioned some of the techniques that have been used over time. Maybe you could say something about that.
I think an analogy here might be going back a few decades with the United States presidency, that Woodrow Wilson was in fact quite incapacitated, and yet the mechanism of state moved forward and the general public were not aware of it. The same thing happened with FDR, that the administration and the press took great pains not to portray him as physically incapacitated. And even more recently with President Kennedy, his medical condition was quite precarious, and yet that was hidden from the general public. Sometimes there may be a good state or institutional reason for doing that, and I won't try to second-guess them on that. At other times, particularly when you see what happened with Steve Benson and other members of his family, you question if it really is serving the public and the family interest the way that it should.
You say limitations have been in some cases masked by controlling public appearances, also masked by, you say, and I'll quote you here, taking advantage of periods of lucidity characteristic of dementia. What do you mean by that?
Well, this is a characteristic of dementia. And when you speak dementia, you're talking in a very broad term because there are different forms, all of which can lead to some type of intellectual impairment. And in most cases, that's about as deep as you can take it because a definitive diagnosis just on behavioral basis is not possible. So what you're talking about is cognitive impairment.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of President McKay, for instance, there were times when he was quite lucid. I interviewed his private physician who took care of him until his death, and he said it would wax and wane. And when he was more lucid, then there were more things that he could weigh in on. When he was less lucid, then the counselors in the Quorum of the Twelve had to do it on their own or defer action if they felt that it wasn't a prerogative that they had.
But that was 50 years ago. Can you say anything about whether that is occurring in the case of Thomas S. Monson? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Okay, you don't know. You can't say that. I want to ask about the consequences of all of this on the actual running of the church, because that is something you deal with in the piece. First of all, you say what often happens in these cases is that there's this power vacuum. Explain that, if you will. I guess there's some sort of maneuvering that happens when a president is incapacitated or a high leader is incapacitated. There has to be some sort of natural maneuvering that goes on. Can you explain maybe how that plays out?
Yeah, and let me look at it from two vantage points. One is things that would happen if a president were in full command may not necessarily happen. And the other is that things that wouldn't happen at the behest of others if there were a strong president in control can happen, and that can lead to unfortunate consequences. In the former case, when President Benson was ailing, President Hinckley was a counselor, and people may recall that there was a death in the Quorum of the Twelve, and that vacancy was not filled. And then there was another death in the Quorum of the Twelve, and that vacancy was not filled. And then there was Apostle Bruce McConkie, who had terminal cancer. Mm-hmm. And so you had the very real prospect of a Quorum of the Nine. And it was at that point that two new apostles, Russell Nelson and Dallin Oaks, were called at the same time. What happened there was that President Hinckley went to President Kimball in a moment of lucidity and presented to him the recommendations for two new apostles, and he gave it his approval. If you go back and look at the conference report, President Hinckley very carefully worded the way that he presented those names. And if you combine that wording with him going to President Kimball during one of these moments of lucidity, it fits that President Hinckley, was not overstepping what he felt to be the constraints of his being a counselor rather than the president, that he had had positive weigh-in from the church presence. So that's an instance where something that normally would have happened immediately upon the death of an apostle was delayed. And finally, President Hinckley was able to take advantage of this moment where he could have that discussion with President Kimball and move forward. The other side is when you have had an incapacitated president, there can be a power vacuum, and things that otherwise would not have happened can happen and have happened, mm-hmm. and that becomes very unfortunate.
You want to mention blacks in the priesthood? This was a
yes.
Because that's a very particular example that you work through. David O. McKay, President David O. McKay, was incapacitated. And so there's this internal power struggle, deep and damaging rift, you in fact describe it as, at the highest level of church governance related to all of that. It's a long story that you work through in the piece, but mention that.
Yes, what happened was in the last year of President McKay's life, a letter written by Sterling McMurrin and sent to the McKay family just to put it on the record for their benefit became knowledge of members of the First Presidency and senior apostles. And the letter recounted a conversation that McMurrin had had with President McKay in the early 1950s, in which President McKay said that the policy of priesthood ordination of blacks was a policy and that it would change. Now, Sterling McMurrin never made that public, but when it inadvertently went public as a result of this letter, then you had two sides that immediately sprang into action. One side was Hugh Brown, who was in the First Presidency, who saw that as an opening to change the policy administratively, and he attempted to do that. Right. Alvin Dyer, an extra counselor in the First Presidency, enlisted the assistance of Harold B. Lee, who was a senior apostle. And Lee, seeing that Brown was trying to change it administratively, blocked him, wrote a letter, and then obliged the two counselors in the First Presidency to sign that letter, reaffirming the status quo of that policy. that clash of the titans, which was carried on behind closed doors as far as the general church membership was concerned, resulted in a substantial rift that really did not get healed. And it was the reason that when President McKay died, Hugh Brown was released from the First Presidency and went back into the Quorum of the Twelve. That was the first time since the death of Brigham Young that a counselor in a First Presidency was released upon the death of a president. And it was very, very traumatic to President Brown.
Hmm. There's another example that you cite, and this happened in, I'm not sure under whose tenure offhand, this might have been Spencer Kimball's, where the church's history department, under the guidance of Leonard Arrington, this highly respected historian, was basically dismantled, that some apostles or members of the First Presidency were able to sort of take advantage of the incapacitation of a church president to accomplish all of that.
Yes, that was during the administration of President Kimball. He had been very supportive both of the history franchise in the church and of Leonard Arrington on a personal basis. Leonard had written a very nice biography of Edwin Woolley, who was one of Spencer Woolley Kimball's ancestors. But as President Kimball's health continued to deteriorate, he became less capable, perhaps less willing, of trying to intercede and maintain the integrity of the history division. And so gradually, some senior apostles succeeded in chipping away at the history division and finally dissolving it and sending the historians packing to BYU.
It's come to be known as the September 6th. There was this purge that played out in 1993 where a number of more Mormon intellectuals and historians were excommunicated. That comes into play here as well. That happened while a church leader was incapacitated.
That's while President Benson, according to Steve Benson, it was a time when his grandfather was totally incapacitated. And the reports that went public, some of them coming from Steve Benson, were that these excommunications were not strictly local matters, but that in fact they had been prodded by a senior apostle. It was not our finest hour, and I think that there was a lot of fallout from that that could have been avoided and probably would have been avoided if there had been a strong leader sitting in the president's chair who would have been able to rein in that kind of rogue activity.
Hmm. You don't spend a lot of time with this particular example, but I do want to reference it because you do mention it in the piece. An example of something that has happened that's had a direct impact on the church of having a leader who is incapacitated. And in this case, it's President Monson, because you say that the recent controversy over the divisive anti-LGBT policy seems like that is also an example. Are you saying that President Monson's apparent cognitive incapacity now has influenced the way that policy was discussed and adopted?
It's still not clear to any of us what the total story is of that. The broad outlines seem to be coalescing a bit, but the details are still wanting. I understood from a very reliable source at a very early time, meaning the evening that that policy was leaked, that the Quorum of the Twelve had not heard of this until 2 days previously, and that they had not been allowed to weigh in on it, have the general discussion about it, and then vote on the proposition. That certainly is not the way the church policy in the past has been formulated and approved. So it suggests that it wasn't business as usual, and we have not had a statement directly from President Monson that might clarify, well, what was the procedure that happened to affect this new policy, and how did all of that unroll?
Right. Explain the importance of having a strong leader. You mentioned Gordon B. Hinckley. And I've often heard, I have to say, you hear this a lot, within the Mormon blogosphere and among others, that Gordon B. Hinckley wouldn't have done it this way, that he wouldn't have, for example, proposed the Prop 8 fight in California, or this LGBT policy, which has been so polarizing and divisive, would not have happened under the strong leadership of Gordon B. Hinckley. Can you say anything about that?
Well, I think that for any organization, having a strong, dynamic, bright, forward-looking leader is going to be an advantage, and anything short of that misses the mark that might otherwise have been hit. I think that an appropriate analogy here is to look at what has happened in the past few years to the Roman Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. That 3 years ago, Pope Benedict, who still arguably was in pretty good command of his faculties, nonetheless felt that for whatever reasons, it was time for him to break precedent and to step down.
Right. Centuries-old precedent, we should point out.
About 700 years worth of precedent.
Yeah.
And that stunned everybody. It sounded from the outside like this was just something that he decided to do and that he didn't assemble a whole bunch of counselors around him to bounce it off of them. He just said it. And the resulting rejuvenation of the Roman Catholic Church worldwide has been astounding. The difference is that you had the exit of Pope Benedict and the entrance of Pope Francis I, and the transformation was almost instantaneous. I think it caught everybody off guard. So that's the possibility. It's the positive side of what can happen if an organization ensures that there is continued vitality and vision at the top.
You often hear that the quorum of the 12 apostles in the first presidency, all 15 are so-called prophets, seers, and revelators. So why would it matter if the guy on top, the president, is incapacitated, even totally incapacitated, if you have 14 other men who are pretty much still engaged and still administering the affairs of the church? Why would it matter that you have one or maybe a few in that group incapacitated?
Well, I think if you look historically, you see that there are, in fact, two different councils there. There's the Council of the First Presidency and there's the Council of the 12. And they do function somewhat independently, and there is a swing in the center of gravity if a church president starts to become incapacitated. Sometimes that center of gravity will remain within the first presidency. That is contingent upon one of the counselors being very senior in the succession. Mm-hmm. That was the case with President Hinckley. Everybody knew that he would be the president, and so even though the church president at the time was incapacitated, they knew who was next in line and they deferred to him.
Right.
If you have a situation, which we've had several times in our lifetime, where the sitting counselors in the first presidency are very junior in seniority,
which is currently
then
the
that
case.
Center of gravity can swing the opposite direction into the quorum of the 12, and that's not always the best outcome.
And that's currently what's essentially how it's constructed. You've got some more junior members of the quorum of the 12 who are in that first presidency.
Yes, with the selection of President Eyring to go into the first presidency, he was the number 10 person in seniority. And with President Uchtdorf, he also was the number 10 person in seniority. So you had two very junior counselors in the first presidency, something we hadn't seen in decades, although if you go back to the McKay years, you saw something similar there.
When we get back from a break, we'll talk about, Greg Prince, what you mentioned are the options for the future. Greg Prince is with us. He co-authored an article called Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism. It's due out in the fall issue of Dialogue. It's a journal focused on Mormon thought and culture. He co-wrote it along with historian Lester Bush and attorney and former Dialogue co-editor Brent Rushforth. We'll take a quick break and come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the researcher Gregory Prince, who says that church presidents in the LDS Church, they live longer these days, of course, and then, of course, they're more likely to experience age-related conditions. It's something he explores in a forthcoming article. It's called Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism. He's joining us today on the program from a studio in Washington, D.C. So let's talk about how sort of the, I guess, the suggestion you're making for church leadership to consider. You say in the piece that you'd have to set age limits for service in the Quorum of the Twelve so that new church presidents would not begin their terms in the ninth or tenth decades of their lives. So how would it work? How do you figure it out?
Well, it would work the same way that they already address the situation with the 70. That in that case, they said, when you reach the age of 70, you will go on emeritus status. Thank you for your service. You could do something similar in the Quorum of the Twelve. I asked one of the 70 who was in on the deliberations that extended over a decade before they announced emeritus status. I said, did you ever suggest to the higher quorums that that's something they should consider? And the way he put it was, that was above our pay grade, but, he said, we opened the door if they had chosen to walk through. So it's not like something new would be invented. It's something that has already been implemented in the third presiding quorum of the church.
Yeah.
The question would be, do you want that to apply to the second presiding quorum? And ultimately, do you want that to apply to the first presiding quorum? If you were to set an age for emeritus for members of the Quorum of the Twelve, then that would dramatically lower the age of a president when he entered that office.
Yeah.
It doesn't address another issue would be, okay, so that man may live into his late 90s. Is that the way that you want to continue, or do you want to establish some type of emeritus status for the president of the church? That's not my call, but I think it's just conceptually a continuation of a policy that they already implemented nearly 40 years ago.
Right.
But they implemented it with a lower council of the church.
Yeah, so you're saying there's precedent. And no, of course, it's not your call, but you are making a suggestion. I mean, you put an age limit. You say you think an age limit of 75 for the Quorum of the Twelve and the first presidency counselors, and 85 for church presidents. And if there are other health problems, you could also consider emeritus status. But
yeah,
what do you?
It's an arbitrary figure, just
sure.
Something to throw out there.
Right.
And yet 85 is not entirely arbitrary, because that's when the population starts to move into that dementia zone.
Right.
And
right.
So there would be a practical consideration for capping it, if you were going to cap it at all, at an age like that.
Right. So I guess you probably realize that if you were to impose such a system today, you would wipe out 9 of the 15 members of the Quorum of the Twelve in the first presidency, and which raises that question of why would these men want to change the system? I mean, if it's possible they could one day be president, and everyone always says the same thing, they don't aspire to be the prophet of Mormonism, but it's, let's be honest, it's a little hard to believe. It's not just a little tempting to one day anticipate coming into such a prominent position. So how do you get these men to agree to limit their opportunity to one day become president of the Mormon Church?
I don't know what the mechanism would be within the Mormon Church, but one can see how it played out within the Roman Catholic Church and within the Community of Christ. And in both of those instances, it was a sitting president or pope fully in command of his faculties and fully empowered in his office saying, I am stepping down. And that may be what would happen here, that a sitting church president certainly has that prerogative if he chose to exercise it. Whether that would be the result of groupthink, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's a way that it could happen. And in the case of those other two institutions, I think that you had sitting leaders who became more and more aware of the fact that if they were to step down, the welfare of the entire religious tradition would be enhanced because there would be a successor who would have more dynamism, more energy to apply to it. I applaud both Pope Benedict and W. Wallace Smith, who was the president of what was then the RLDS Church, for their courage in making that decision, because it had to be the most difficult decision of their lives. Yeah. And yet, in both cases, the institution not only didn't suffer, but was, I think, regenerated as a result.
How would you respond to the idea that there might be some larger lesson here for church members, that mortality limits everyone's capacity in some way? And so working through that, seeing a leader physically diminished, and Mormons were able to see their leader physically diminished at the last general conference, barely able to muster much more than a few minutes in these, you know, very basic sort of gospel talks. But maybe there's some idea that this will impart a life lesson, that we're seeing, you know, frailty, we're seeing mortality. How do you respond to that? Because I've heard that idea before.
Well, I don't think that there would be many, if any, church members who would be averse to the idea of an ailing church leader being able to step aside with dignity.
Yeah.
I think people would embrace that. I think that they would applaud that. It's not that they're against the status quo, but I think our sympathies really go out to a man who is standing at the podium doing his best to perform to a worldwide audience, but it just becomes more and more apparent how taxing this is and how difficult this man, difficult the situation is that this man is facing. I think everybody's sympathy is already going out to him, wishing that it didn't have to be this way.
That's Gregory Prince. He's an independent historian, co-author of an article called Gerontocracy and the Future of Mormonism, which is due out in the next issue of Dialogue. It's a Mormon-focused quarterly journal. He co-wrote it with Lester Bush and Brent Rushforth. Greg Prince joined us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Thanks very much for taking the
time. You're welcome, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.